Welcome to this Egyptology Online podcast recorded at the University of Manchester. My name is Dr. Nicky Nilsson.
And my name is Dr. Joyce Tilsley.
And today we're going to be talking about one of the giants of Egyptology, or the man archaeologists love to hate, as he's also been described, Giovanni Battista Belzoni.
Yes, and when you say he's a giant of Egyptology, you're being quite literal, aren't you?
Yes, I am. He was a very, very tall man, over 6 feet.
Yeah, I read that his contemporaries said that he was 7 foot tall, but I think they probably were guessing that because that would have been really, really tall for his age.
Yeah, that does seem quite significant, yeah.
But his height, his size influenced his early career, I think.
It did, very much. His early career is a bit strange because his father was actually a barber and wanted Giovanni to follow in his footsteps, and Giovanni definitely didn't want to be a barber. So he ran away to Rome. And later on, he claimed to have studied hydraulics.
Well, he does seem to, later in his career, which we'll come to, I suppose, he does seem to have a flair for hydraulics and a flair for sort of water flows and so on like that, which has helped him in his
engineering
Egyptology
project. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And unfortunately for him, his stay in Rome was interrupted by the arrival of the French army.
Well, this is something that really interests me because I think we underestimate how much the Napoleonic Wars have such an influence on Egyptology today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not just actually because Napoleon went to Egypt, but the number of people who were affected with it, not just Belzoni, but Champollion, for example,
spent his
entire life being worried, or part of his life in it, being worried that he was going to be enlisted into the army.
Another early explorer, Jean-Jacques Rifault, was actually enlisted into Napoleon's armies and chose to desert and run away and study Egypt instead. So yeah, it seems to be a common theme around that time.
Absolutely a defining moment in Egyptology.
And Belzoni had no interest in being press ganged into the French army, so he fled Rome with his brother and traveled to Amsterdam, where I believe he made a living selling very, very dodgy relics.
I didn't know that. I thought that he studied hydraulics there as well because of all the dams and so on, that he would be interested in them. But I don't know.
I've seen him described there as a petty merchant, selling pots and pans and false relics, basically.
I think what's interesting is that he clearly is a man of great ability and great enterprise and great drive. But he's not wealthy, is he? He doesn't have any sort of backup plan. He's always having to earn his own living.
He's the son of a barber from Padua in northern Italy. He's not really anyone special.
But I think later in his career, when he starts to collect artifacts, it's very easy to blame him for selling them on and trying to make money out of ancient Egypt, which today we would very much frown on, but we can see why he did it. It's his only way of getting a living.
Yeah, and I think also there's a tendency perhaps for our time to be a bit overly judgmental, because he wasn't the only one selling artifacts.
Oh no!
By any means, everyone was selling artifacts. He wasn't really doing anything out of the ordinary. He just did it very well.
Yes.
And very successfully. So after his brief stay in Amsterdam, he went to London at the beginning of the 19th century.
We can see him at Sadler's Wells Theatre doing various strongman acts. He had a human pyramid, which seems very appropriate.
Yeah, and literally carried around members of the theatre company on a sort of specially constructed harness, apparently.
He did. I read somewhere that his wife Sarah actually climbed onto the top of the pyramid and waved a flag when she was on the top of it, keeping it in the family.
Well, he also, aside from his sort of acrobatics, he was also an actual actor. He performed in several plays in Sadler's Wells Theatre. Quite interestingly, they redid the theatre shortly after Belzoni arrived, with the ability to flood part of the stage. Again, a water hydraulic thing that Belzoni may have consulted on.
Yes.
So they could perform various very kind of patriotic plays. One of my favorite plays that he acted in is called A Fig for the French and The Siege of Gibraltar, which apparently had actual miniature battleships on the stage, and explosions and sort of various daring do themes going on.
Oh, fantastic. But obviously underpinning that, there's a good deal of engineering knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, certainly. Sarah, you mentioned his wife. We unfortunately don't know very much about her.
No, she seems to have been a really intrepid character. She's well worth looking up because she had her own adventures apart from
absolutely,
his.
Yeah.
And of course, she spent a lot of time in Egypt, which must have been quite unusual for a woman of her generation.
Yeah, and unfortunately, she's just been very badly sort of recorded in history. We don't even really know where she's from. Her maiden name seems to have been Ban, Sarah Bain or Ban. She may have been from Bristol or possibly from Ireland. We know that she met Charles Dickens, which is interesting. He describes her as, I think, a pretty delicate woman, which certainly she... Delicate, I wouldn't describe her as that. I don't know how pretty she was or not, but she was certainly quite feisty, a bit of a character as well.
Yeah, and she accompanied him pretty much on everything he did.
Yeah, absolutely. So after their kind of experiences in London, they seem to have led a quite nomadic lifestyle, sort of travelling from circus to circus around Europe. Until they happened to bump into, I believe, one of the envoys of Ibrahim Pasha.
Yes, they were in Malta.
In Malta,
and they'd met the envoy. And the envoy was looking for somebody to design a water wheel for Egypt.
Yeah.
Because the idea was to modernise Egypt. They were very much stuck in the past, and the idea was to get it to become a more modern society.
Yeah, and increase its agricultural potential as well, which Egypt always has always had a great deal of agricultural potential.
So the Belzonis, well, Belzoni himself saw a challenge and went to Egypt and designed a water wheel.
Yeah, and actually demonstrated it as well.
It didn't go all as he planned, unfortunately. It worked very, very well. But then it was decided to try it with humans driving it
rather than oxen. Yeah.
Yes, and it ended up with his servant, James Curtin, ended up with a broken leg.
Yeah.
And that was the end of the water wheel for Belzoni, and he suddenly found himself penniless and in Egypt and had to find something else to do.
And not particularly popular with the Egyptian court either.
No.
After the little failed demonstration.
So the one thing he turned to next, that was open to him with a man of his skill set, was to collect antiquities for other people, principally for Henry Salt, who was himself collecting antiquities for the British. Other people were doing the same. And it's these collections made at this time which forms basis of the collections in many of the national museums in Europe today.
I mean, Henry Salt was essentially the British consul to Egypt, and his collection makes up a great deal of the British Museum today. And Belzoni's rival, Bernardino Drovetti, I don't know whether that's been exaggerated by history, but they were certainly not exactly the best of friends at every point.
Well, no, because Belzoni, although Italian, was working for the British. And
Bernardino Drovetti, although also Italian,
was working for the French. And obviously the British and the French weren't on the best of terms at this time. So there was this conflict, or you read about this conflict.
Yeah, I believe actually shots were exchanged at one at one point between their teams of workers. But Drovetti seems to have... Personally, I think part of the reason Drovetti has got a bit of a bad rep, at least in English language publications on Belzoni, is in part also because of that stunning portrait of him where he literally looks like a cartoon villain with this very curly moustache. But his methods seem to have been even more brutal than Belzoni in terms of extracting profit.
Yes,
from antiquities.
I get the impression that he had more money at his disposal, so he had teams of men working. I mean, Belzoni did too.
Yeah.
But Drovetti had men all over the place working, and he was rarely on site.
Yeah, he also seemed... I mean, I heard a story of him where he basically, after finding four inscribed alabaster vessels, Belzoni ordered his men to destroy three of them and crush them to powder to basically enhance the rarity value of the single surviving one. Whether that's true...
But it could well be true, because that's not unusual. You also hear stories of people finding papyrus and cutting them into pieces, because they'll get more for each piece than they would for one long roll. Or sometimes, you know, what's happened to all these pieces? Can we put them together again? Not necessarily so, because some have been lost.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we have to remember at this time that the antiquities were seen as curiosities rather than keys to Egypt's past. They were almost dumb. They couldn't be understood properly. But all the same, it's very hard to imagine finding a beautiful illustrated papyrus and cutting it into sections.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. Or knocking the head off a statue to sell the statue and the head separately so you could get more money. It's a strange thing.
But you do hear about this happening.
So Belzoni's first kind of major task in Egypt was moving the Memnon Colossus.
The
younger Memnon.
From the Ramesseum in Thebes.
To the Nile?
Yes. Something that other people had wanted to do but couldn't do because they didn't have the skill set to do it. And this is where the hydraulic training and the years of engineering practice in the theatre really came came to the fore, and Belzoni was able to do it.
And also, I mean, it should be said also, I think his native workers need to be remembered as well, because certainly from the illustrations, it wasn't just Belzoni's kind of ingenuity, it was certainly also their very, very hard work over several weeks.
A
lot of brute strength. Yeah, absolutely. He also travelled quite far south and made some interesting discoveries at Abu Simbel. And in fact, he cleared the temple entrance.
Yes, the temple had been discovered, but it was completely clogged up with sand.
Yeah.
And it was impossible to get inside. And in fact, some people thought there wasn't an inside. Some people just thought it was a facade.
Yeah.
And there was nothing behind it. But Belzoni realised that there was, and he cleared away the sand. And eventually, on his second trip there, he was able to slide inside and see what was inside it.
And did some beautiful watercolours.
Absolutely.
Well, of the interior.
Unfortunately, it didn't stay free of sand. And the locals, again, would actually let it silt up, and then would, if travellers came and wanted to see it, they would charge them to dig it out again.
Yes. that's a good racket, isn't it? He also worked in the Valley of the Kings, finding, I think, personally, I think it's his greatest discovery, but that's a very subjective thing, the tomb of Seti I.
Yes, and the beautiful alabaster sarcophagus inside it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it very amusingly, when Belzoni discovered the tomb, rumors started flying almost instantly that he'd discovered a great golden treasure, as these things have a tendency to do even today.
This always happens.
It does always happen, yes. The local headman basically came riding, apparently with a battalion of cavalrymen, charging into the Valley of the Kings to ask to see this great golden cockerel, studded and filled with diamonds, that Belzoni had found. And it's quite amazing that in a matter of hours, the discovery of the tomb, which had no gold in it, but just a lot of shapties, had not just become a great treasure, but had become something so specific.
Yes.
And Belzoni laughed essentially at the headman, and said, pointed to all these beautifully preserved paintings in the tomb, and said, "Aren't these treasure enough?" And the headman looked quite disappointed and said, "Well, it might do as a harem, because then the women would have something to look at." and left the tomb quite disappointed that was the only thing that had been found.
This happens an awful lot.
It does.
For people excavating Egypt.
It does, even today.
Yes, as soon as something is found, rumours fly around that golden treasures have been found.
And it grows in the telling.
Yes.
It grows a lot.
I mean, I didn't say before, but when we talk about the Abu Simbel temple, one of the rumours was that if there was something inside, it was filled with gold.
Yeah.
Because the locals couldn't understand why Western people kept coming to it and wanting to get inside it unless there was some gold there.
Yeah.
And at the site of Amarna, where there are boundary steelers set around the site, big sort of, they look like doors, rock-cut, flat rock faces around the site cut into the cliffs. Some of them have been blown up because people actually think that they are doorways, or thought that they were actually doorways with treasures behind them, which, of course, is not the case.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very rare anywhere on any archaeological excavation that you just find a load of gold. It's quite rare. I think Tutankhamun might have had something to do with the fascination, but
guess
also just...
But this is before that, though.
Yes, that's true.
I think it was possibly that the local workmen just couldn't understand why these Westerners were coming to take these pieces of stone that had just been hanging around for ages, unless there was some hidden value to them that wasn't immediately obvious.
Yeah, that's true. So after his work in the Valley of the Kings in Abu Simbel, Belzoni went home and did a very beautiful exhibition in London.
The Egyptian Hall, appropriately.
Yeah.
Very, very popular. A lot of people came to see it. It started with a mummy unrolling.
Yes, yeah.
And a lot of people came to see it. So he was one of the first, really, to make Egypt totally accessible to a very wide, popular audience.
Yeah, and also, I mean, he was a showman
to the
hilt. I mean, the exhibition, he acted as a tour guide of the exhibition, dressed in Arabic robes and with his very long black beard and long black hair, really looking, I think, every inch the showman that, well, he really was.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the end of his life is far less kind of theatrical. He went on a expedition to Timbuktu. Made it to the kingdom of Benin, and it's a little bit unclear, isn't it, what happened to him there?
I'd read that he got ill.
Yeah, and dysentery.
Dysentery, and just died and was buried under a tree, but the grave is now lost.
Yeah, although later explorers have claimed that he was actually robbed and murdered, so it's a little bit unclear precisely what happened to him or where his body is.
And poor Sarah hadn't gone on this trip with him. She was left behind and she didn't believe for a long time that he wasn't going to come back.
Yeah.
She ended up in poverty.
She did, yes. She was very rudely ignored, essentially, by the kind of scholarly community.
She was. I think eventually she managed to get a very small pension, and she ended up, she died in the Channel Islands, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she did. She lived in Brussels for a while as well, during the sort of last years of her life before moving to the Channel Islands.
So that's the story of Belzoni.
Yeah, as I said, the giant archaeologists love to hate. I think we're both frustrated by his methods and a little bit fascinated by his life.
Yes,
It's not the sort of thing you see these days.
No, it's not, definitely not.
But yeah, we hope you enjoyed it.